A couple of minutes later, the car backed out of the garage. The motor gunned for the two-block trip, and they were gone. Ruth came into my room, bent over and picked up the flowery chenille bedspread that had fallen to the floor and asked, "Are you feeling all right?" I remembered who had brought me the ice bag and aspirins for my head and the ointment for my legs. "I don't know. I guess I am." From the other twin bed came a long, low, early morning sound as Sharon flopped over to a better dreaming position.
"Come on into the kitchen,"
whispered Ruth as she tiptoed out of the room. The marshmallow slowly began to bleed its whiteness all over the steaming cup of chocolate. On the shelf of the breakfast room's built-in cabinet, our one surviving goldfish, Goldilocks, began her vigorous after-breakfast swim.
"How come that fish got sense enough to eat her breakfast and you don't?"
asked Ruth as she sat down at the table. I ignored the buttered toast and scrambled egg, but took a long drink of the now lukewarm chocolate.
"Don't know, except maybe Goldilocks has a better cook than I do." "Must be the truth,"
Ruth smiled, showing her left-of-center solid gold tooth.
"You know what you need, honey. One of them fancy Frenchmen who cooks up a fine dinner and just for serving it, he sets it all afire."
We sat for a while in silence, Ruth taking small, now and then sips of coffee while I sat stirring my chocolate and watching Goldilocks. Ruth's spoon made an attention-getting noise, and I saw that those brown eyes were upon me.
"I want you to tell Ruth the truth about something. You hear me talking, girl?"
I nodded yes.
"You tell me who is the man."
"Man?"
"Honey, babe, you can tell Ruth. The man that ran out from the garage. The man that wanted to save you from your daddy."
"That man, the man, the..." My voice was still in some kind of working order, even if my brain did just up and die. How can those eyes that rest so lightly see so deeply? And from them there is nothing in this world to fear. "The man is my friend," I said at last.
"You got him hid up in them rooms over the garage?"
"Yes." Ruth sighed like she sometimes does before tackling a really big job.
"He's not the one the law's after."
"Not the one from the prison camp?"
"Yes." Her forehead crinkled up like a washboard.
"You telling me yes, he's not the one?"
"No, Ruth. I'm telling you yes. Yes, he's the one." Ruth's head moved back and forth in a no direction.
"Oh, Lord, why are you sending us more, Lord? Don't this child and me have burden enough?"
I stood up and felt this sensation of lightness, near weightlessness, like somebody had just bent down, picked up, and carried away all my trouble. My arm fell across Ruth's shoulder. "Everything'll be all right. Honest, it will." Beneath my arm, there was no movement, no feeling of life. I squeezed Ruth's shoulder, and a hearable breath rushed through her nostrils. "You know how you're all the time helping me because you're my friend? Well, Anton's my friend, and I have to help him, you know? Don't you know?"
"I don't know what it is I know," she said in a weighted voice.
In the pantry there was plenty of peanut butter, but the jar of strawberry jam was only fingernail high. I turned on the gas burner under the aluminum percolator. I began to worry that maybe prison camp food was better than this, but at least the loaf of white bread was yesterday fresh. Ruth followed me into the kitchen.
"Honey, them peanut butter and jelly sandwiches ain't no kind of breakfast for no kind of man."
She looked up at the kitchen clock.
"After I bring Sharon down to Sue Ellen's, I'll fix up some hot griddle cakes with maple syrup and a fresh pot of coffee."
I threw my arms as far around Ruth's waist as they would go and tried to lift her up by the pure strength of my will.
"Oh, Ruth, you're good, good, good." "Now, girl, don't go expecting no amount of praise to turn my mind about, 'cause my mind ain't come to no clear thought yet. All I knows for sure is that I'm gonna fix up a proper breakfast for you and the man."
"Okay, thanks. But would you mind not calling him the man, 'cause he's my friend, Anton. Mr. Frederick Anton Riker. You may not know this, but you and Anton are all the friends I've got." Ruth nodded slowly.
"I understand that, honey."
That understanding made me want to tell her everything all at once. "Ruth, he talks to me, and he tells me things because I'm his friend. Ruth, he likes me. He really and truly likes me."
"I knows that, too."
My heart swelled up, for if Ruth knows it, it must be the truth.
"How do you know that? Tell me how you know."
She gave my arm a couple of short pats before finding my eyes.
"That man come a-rushin' out from the safety of his hidin', 'cause he couldn't stand your pain and anguish no better'n me. That man listens to the love in his heart. Like the Bible tells us, when a man will lay down his life for a friend, well, then there ain't no greater love in this here world than that."
Before I reached the landing, I heard his footsteps, and then the door opened. I felt certain he was smiling a welcome, although I was looking past him into the familiar interior of the room, much as I would look past the brilliance of the sun.
"How are you?"
he asked, making it sound more like an inquiry than a greeting. "Fine." Cowardliness kept me from looking at him.
"Did you sleep okay? Were you too hot?" I asked.
"No." The shortness of his answer frightened me. Maybe it's disgust for what he saw yesterday. My eyes shut in a feeble try at pushing away the memories.
"Sure, you're all right."
His eyes were on the red raw stripes that crisscrossed my legs. I moved quickly to the opposite side of the desk.
"Oh, yes, thanks."
"About yesterday."
"It's okay."
"No,"
he said with a force I'd never heard him use before.
"It's not okay.
Listen to me, PB. What happened yesterday bothers me. Tell me if I was in any way responsible." Between his eyebrows there was a deep crease, a mark of concern for me. All that painful dabbing of layer after layer of face powder that I subjected my legs to may have been a mistake. Concern might be a little like love.
"It wasn't you," I said. "You weren't responsible."
"Then what?"
"Please tell me what you did to deserve such a beating." How could I say in words what I couldn't really understand myself? Sometimes I think it's because I'm bad that my father wants to do the right thing by beating it out of me. And at other times I think he's beating out from my body all his own bad. My head began its confused revolutions. "Come over to the window," I said finally, pointing towards the tracks. "You see over there? The shack with the tin roof? There's a boy who lives there who my father told me I'm not to have anything to do with. Yesterday, he saw Freddy sitting next to me on our front steps. I told Anton about sleepy Freddy who cuts grass in his spare time so he can make enough money to sleep during the Saturday matinee. Scholarly Freddy, who has been in Miss Bailey's fourth grade for 2 years because he's finally found the one teacher I likes. Fearless Freddy, brave hunter of crawdads. And generous Freddy, who once bought me the gift of not quite half of a melted mess of a Hershey bar." "He sounds perfectly delightful," said Anton with a smile. "But why is your father so opposed to him?" "Maybe it's because he's so poor, but I'm not sure." He looked a little perplexed. "Why don't you inquire?" "I can't inquire." My words had a harshness that I didn't intend. In my father's vocabulary, to ask why is to contradict him. "I don't like him." The words seemed to dash out. Then Anton caught my eyes as though asking permission. "Oh, that's okay," I said, pleased that Anton was taking my side. "I'll tell you something I've never told anyone before. If he weren't my father, I wouldn't even like him." "But because he is, you do?" "Oh, well, I guess I..." Then the image came, the image of his thin, rabid face. "I guess I don't too much. No, I don't like him." That was the first time I had even thought anything like that myself. Funny, but Edna Louise once told me, "Your daddy is so sweet." Probably because every time he sees her, he says, "Edna Louise, you sure do look pretty today." To Edna Louise, he has to say nice things as if she weren't conceited enough. "Do you have any idea where your father went? What he did immediately following the beating he gave you?" "Not exactly. I could guess. He probably went into the house, smoked a Lucky Strike cigarette, washed his hands, and ate a perfectly enormous supper while he listened to the evening news." "Not true." "He stood watching the housekeeper help you into the house. Then he came into the garage and talked to himself. Over and over, he kept repeating, 'Nobody loves me. In my whole life, nobody has ever loved me.'" "Anton, it must have been somebody else. That doesn't sound like my father."
"It was your father."
"I don't understand. Why? How could he be so mean and then worry that he isn't loved? It doesn't make sense." Anton shook his head.
"I met your father once.
I interpreted for some of the prisoners who came into the store. I remember. You said the prisoners needed hats to protect themselves from our formidable Arkansas sun." Anton smiled, and the smile made him look very young. More like a boy my age than a man.
"How could you possibly remember that?"
"Easy. Nobody from around here says things like that. I also remember that he didn't think your remark was very amusing."
"I can believe that because..."
Anton paused like he was trying to put some new thoughts into good running order before continuing. "Because it seems to me that a man who is incapable of humor is capable of cruelty. If Hitler, for example, had had the ability, the detachment, to observe the absurdity of his own behavior, he would have laughed, and today there might not be a madman named Adolf Hitler. Was he making a comparison between Hitler and my father? Do you think my father is like that? Like Hitler? Anton looked thoughtful. Cruelty is, after all, cruelty, and the difference between the two men may have more to do with their degrees of power than their degrees of cruelty. One man is able to affect millions and the other only a few. Would your father's cruelty cause him to crush weak neighboring states? Or would the Führer's cruelty cause him to beat his own daughter? Doesn't it seem to you that they both need to inflict pain?
I don't know.
Anton smiled.
I don't know either. But you see, the only questions I like to raise are those that are unanswerable. Trying to calculate the different degrees of cruelty is a lot like trying to calculate the different degrees of death. I laughed, but I knew that tonight, while our house slept, I would stay awake trying to understand his words.
I'm so glad you're talking to me, teaching me. I heard my enthusiasm running over. I want you to teach me everything you've learned.
Anton stood, executing a princely bow.
I'm at your service. I think I want to be intelligent even more than I want to be pretty.
You're already intelligent and pretty.
Me?
You. I come from a line of men who have a sure instinct for a woman's beauty. So, PB, I speak as an expert when I tell you you're going to have it all.
Well, why hasn't anyone else seen it? That I'm going to have what you say?
They will. Because you are no common garden flower. You are unique.
Oh. I think I'm going to enjoy being your teacher if you'll keep in mind that life produces no maestros, only students of varying degrees of ineptitude.
Wait, said Anton. He jumped from his chair to go rummaging through a GI regulation duffel bag. Here it is. He waved a book with a bruised blue cover. I checked it out of the prison library the same day I checked myself out. R.W. Emerson. Are you familiar with his work? I admitted that I wasn't, while I wondered if escaping with a book could be called anything besides stealing. My father would never do anything like that.
Anton asked,
Is something wrong?
No. Well, I was wondering how you are going to return the book.
Oh, he said thoughtfully. You want to know if I am a thief?
Oh, no. I know you're not.
In this classroom, we call things by their rightful name. I became a thief when I took that book. I couldn't very well pay for it, and I didn't want my brain to starve if I had to go into hiding.
I felt close to laughing. You're very honest. I mean, you don't lie, do you?
Anton shook his head. I try never to lie to myself, and I dislike lying to friends.
He took a yellow pencil from his hip pocket and made two small check marks in R.W. Emerson's table of contents.
Read these essays, he said, like he felt pleased to be making a contribution to my education. And tomorrow we can start mining the gold.
Then a voice from below us called up,
Come on, folks, it's ready.
Anton's face was caught in a moment of fear.
"It's all right," I whispered. "That's only Ruth, our housekeeper. She's made griddle cakes for us."
He looked at me. "Why did you tell?" He believed. He actually believed that I would. "But I didn't, honest. Ruth saw you run out of the garage last night. She saw how you wanted to protect me from my father." Anton's hand rushed to his forehead. "I came running out of hiding to... My God, I did, didn't I?" His hand dropped to his side, and I could see he was smiling his wonderful, glad-to-be-living smile. "After almost 2 years of being as inconspicuous a coward as possible, I had no idea that I would voluntarily risk my life for anyone." He shook his head in disbelief. "But I'm glad I could. I'm glad I still could." Chapter 12. A playful breeze brought a scent of roses into the breakfast room, where it mingled with the purely kitchen aroma of coffee perking, griddle cakes rising, and bacon frying. The table was set for two with real cotton napkins, the newest of the everyday tablecloths, and our fancy dinner time made in Japan, China. Ruth pointed to the chair where my father always sits, and Anton sat down. His appetite was healthy, and while we ate, I heard Ruth singing in the kitchen. "Rinse so white, rinse so white, happy little wash day song." She came into the breakfast room carrying the percolator and refilled the empty cups. Anton rose, pulling out a third chair. "Come join us." I watched Ruth's face for signs of embarrassment, for I was sure no white man had ever before offered her a chair. But if there was any, Ruth has better camouflage than the United States Army. "Mr. Riker, don't you worry none about me. I just enjoys cooking for folks who enjoy eating." There it is. That's one of the things that Ruth does that makes the white lady say she's uppity. All the other colored folks would have called him Mr. Anton, leaving the poor whites the privilege of calling him Mr. Riker. But then, if Ruth played the piano, I think she'd play only the cracks between the keys. She seems best suited for walking that thinnest of lines between respectfulness and subservience. After a while, Ruth brought in a cup of coffee and made herself comfortable in the chair that Anton had selected for her. Looking over at him, she chuckled.
"Yes, sir. It is a pleasure to cook for folks who enjoys their food. They sure ain't no eaters in this house. Not Sharon and not..." She threw a nod over in my direction. "This child. She'd rather be sitting with me shelling peas than eating them. Mr. Bergen, he'd rather be left alone with his cigarettes. And Miss Bergen says she's got to watch her girlish figure." "Imagine that," said Ruth. "A woman that bore two children wants a figure like some young girls. I always tells her, a fruit-bearing tree knows better than to try to look like some young sapling." Anton laughed. "You've been talking to my mother. Except she would have quoted the Bible. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven."
"A time to be born," supplied Ruth, "and a time to die."
Soon Ruth and Anton found a second point of agreement, that a good cook needs an appreciative eater or two. Then Ruth asked something a little surprising. It was something that she might have wondered out loud to me, but not to any other white person.
"How do they treat the colored folks there in Germany?"
"There aren't any." Ruth's face slowly turned incredulous.
"Then how do you folks keep your houses clean?"
I watched Anton laugh without making a sound. The German housewife treats dirt as her mortal enemy. Anyway, our houses are fine. It's our politics and hearts that give us the trouble.
It ain't only in your country, Mr. Riker. No, sir. We got plenty bad hearts right here in America. When I was just a girl, I remembers my mama saying, things gonna be a lot better for Ma Ruth. Ma Ruth's smart, and she's gonna grow up to be a teacher. But my mama was wrong. She didn't figure on them bad hearts, no, sir. And Mr. J.G. Jackson's daddy was one of them.
Ruth's eyes rolled downward to the sun-speckled linoleum floor.
He's gone on his reward now, Mr. Eugene Jackson. Well, back then he used to keep my mama's savings for her in his office safe. Every Saturday for so many years, my mama would go into Mr. Jackson's office in the back of the cotton gin with 50 or 75 cents in her hand and tell him, put this in the envelope, Mr. Jackson. Put this away, please, for my girl's education. Well, when the time come for me to go away to teacher's school, there weren't but $3.25 in that envelope.
Is it possible that the rich would steal from the poor? Why hadn't she ever told me that story before? After all, that was my friend Edna Louise's grandfather. Ruth, how come you never told me before about what Mr. Jackson did to you?
'Cause telling bad stories about the dead ain't the best way to be spending time. And I ain't proud of myself, even if I did just tell it for purposes of illustration.
Then almost on signal, we all began silently to watch the white dotted Swiss curtains respond to the gentle change in the wind. The breakfast room was filled with lazy warmth, and I wondered if there was any better place to be than here. Here with my two favorite people getting to know each other. Though after a while, when you start to feel more the hardness of the chair than the softness of its cushion, it would be good if just the two of us could get up and take a walk together down Main Street. I'd introduce him as my good friend, Anton, Anton Riker. And when he'd look back at me and smile, everybody would see, plain as day, that this beautiful man really liked me. Ruth's spoon sounded against the saucer beneath her cup.
When I had my boy, my Robert, she looked over at Anton. He's about your age now. I said, like my mama before me said, things gonna be different for my child, 'cause I ain't gonna save no money in no white man's private safe, no sir. I put it all in the Rice County National Bank where Mr. John Rusk marked down every deposit in a little blue book. And so one fine day I saw my dream come true. On that day, just before the sun come up, Claude and me walked Robert down to the railroad station. And in his hand Robert was carrying all the things in a suitcase the church had given him the Sunday before. When they flagged down the Atlanta train, that one that was going to take him to Morehouse College, I pulled out my handkerchief and Robert said, "Don't you cry none, Ma. I leave here only a man, but I'm going to come back to you a true minister of God." And he would have been, too, excepting for the letter he got a few precious months later from Mr. Price Cook, the head man of the draft board. I went right down to Cook Brothers Furniture and Appliances store, and I plained to him how this is Robert's one chance in this world, and I begged him to just let my boy finish up his schooling. Let him become a true minister of the gospel. "Ruth, I'm surprised at you," he told me. "You ought to know I can't do that. Why, this is your boy's country, too, and he's got to do his share so this country will always belong to us Americans."
Funny, but Ruth never talked like that to me. Oh, sometimes she says just enough of something to let me know it is all a lie what the white folks keep saying. That lie they tell each other so often that they come to believe it's true. I understands these niggers. They're happy and they don't know no better.
Mr. Riker.
She called his name slowly, thoughtfully.
You're a smart man. I was wondering, do you reckon that this here world is ever gonna amount to much?
Call me Anton. Well, I'm not exactly overburdened by excessive optimism. For centuries, men have believed that religion is the answer. Ruth, as if by instinct, clutched the gold cross at her throat. But I have seen the evil perpetrated by religious men. Did you know that before every battle, Hitler calls upon God for victory? Anton paused to make sure his point had sunk in. A lot of people today believe education can save the world. I used to believe that, but I became discouraged while watching the educated Germans express their enthusiasm for this war. To give you an example, he said, looking from Ruth to me, would one of you ask me what is the oldest tradition in the proud University of Göttingen? What is their oldest tradition? I asked, feeling like a parrot.
Dueling. The Landsmannschaft.
He stopped short like he had just run into a snag. I don't know if you have anything like this in your country or not. It's a secret society. The word means clan.
We have the clan, sure do, responded Ruth.
Well, the Landsmannschaften would challenge each other to a duel on any pretext, Anton continued. Sometimes even the narrow sidewalk of Göttingen was disputed by students from opposing clans. It's called defending their honor. I think maybe good changes will come when our leaders are better and there aren't any more evil dictators, I said. Anton nodded. There are those who would agree with you. But leaders don't usually spring forth to impose their will upon a helpless people. They, like department stores, are in business to give people what they think they want. So basically, you always come back to people. How do you make better people?
I believes, said Ruth, the Lord himself would be mighty interested in creating better people. But if the Lord already knows how to do it, then I don't. So you just tell me.
Maybe psychiatry, I offered. I read in the Reader's Digest where lots of people are helped to be better by psychiatry. Anton's lips pressed together. Maybe. Maybe not. Why can't you believe it? I challenged. The Reader's Digest wouldn't say it if it wasn't so. Anton grinned. He looked like a charter member of Our Gang Comedy. Maybe you're right. But maybe, just maybe, we all have an enormous capacity for believing in anything that will provide us with a bit of comfort. Anton caught Ruth's eye. Haven't you found this to be true?
I'll tell you the truth, Mr. Anton. Yes, sir. I found this here a cold world, a mighty cold world. And a man and a woman, well, they needs a little comforting before they freeze to death.
I can't argue with that, said Anton heavily, as though conceding to Ruth. You don't believe in religion, or education, or psychiatry, I said, holding up three fingers. Is there anything at all you do believe in? Of course. Anton raised the coffee to his lips and when he replaced the cup, it was empty. I believe that love is better than hate, and that there is more nobility in building a chicken coop than in destroying a cathedral. Ruth nodded in affirmation. Ain't it the truth? Suddenly, I heard the crunch of driveway gravel over the low hum of a car motor. Ruth clasped her heart.
Mr. Bergen, Lordy, it's him. Hide him, Patty, under your bed, quick.
As I led Anton to my bedroom, I squeezed his hand so he'd know we would never betray him. Anton's hand left mine as he slid under the maple bed. Out in the driveway, a voice called Ruth's name. A woman's voice. I cautiously lifted one slant of the Venetian blind to see Mrs. Hankins, little Sue Ellen's mother, protruding her beauty parlor coiffure out of the car window.
Is it okay to take Sharon to Wind City with us? I have to buy Sue Ellen a pair of tap dancing shoes.
Yes, Miss Hankins, I reckon it'll be okay. What time you figuring on returning?
I didn't hear Mrs. Hinkins answer, but the car backed down the driveway and took off in the direction of Wind City. In the breakfast room, we three sat totally absorbed in watching agitated curtains being egged on by a suddenly gusty wind. It was as though we were all waiting for something to happen. After a while, Anton spoke. About what happened, I'm sorry. There's no reason why you both should have to take risks. Tonight, when it's dark, I'll go.
I'll pack you up some food to take with you,
said Ruth with unaccustomed speed.
And I have a couple of dollars and some change you can have.
Did she realize what she was saying? Did she understand that he meant to leave us for good?
We're not afraid of anything, really.
And it's not safe for you to leave here. They're all looking for you, Anton. You tell him, Ruth, tell him. But Ruth didn't say anything. She got up from her chair, letting her eyes sweep across the table as she picked up the empty coffee cups and carried them off to the kitchen. Chapter 13. From over at the button factory, the 5 o'clock whistle blew, which didn't mean a thing since quitting time wasn't for another hour. I leaned back against the front stoop and tried to come up with the logic behind a 5 o'clock whistle. But two men were all that I could think of. If I ever had to sacrifice one for the other, which one would it be? The one who had fed and sheltered me, or the one whom I had fed and sheltered? Sharon came out the front door, clutching her baby Jane doll by the hair. Sharon. Pretty Sharon. If I'd been born that pretty, maybe they would like me as much as her. And she's going to be about as popular as Betty Grable. My father says that in a few years, the boys will be swarming about thick as flies. She sat down.
My baby has a boo-boo.
Sharon pointed to a dark smudge on the doll's forehead. Rock your baby in your arms, I told her, and tell her that you love her. Sharon swayed back and forth and in a small voice began to chant.
I love you, little baby. I love you, little baby. I love you, love you, love you, little baby.
6 o'clock came before my thoughts had congealed into plans. My father's green Chevy pulled into the driveway and stopped inside the garage. How close were the two men now? In yards, feet, and inches, exactly how far above my father is Anton. Funny. But with just a little information from me, My father could achieve an instant acceptance in this town. The kind that he has wanted all his life. And it would only take one phone call. Hello, Sheriff Caldwell? Yes, this is Harry Bergen. I've got your Nazi. Yes, he's hiding in the rooms above my garage. Now here's what I want you to do. Mr. Harry Bergen, prominent local merchant. His picture would be in all the newspapers. The president, or J. Edgar Hoover at the very least, would pin a medal on him, and the Jenkinsville Rotarians would call him a hero. And then one evening, after all the commotion had died down, I'd be sitting alone on the screened-in porch. In the twilight, he'd come out, and without saying a word, he'd sit beside me on the metal glider. After a while, he'd casually drop his arm around my shoulder and say, "I haven't been much of a father, have I?" It would take me a couple of swallows before I could manage to say, "Oh, you've been all right, really." We'd just sit there for a while longer, not saying anything. Every once in a while, though, he'd give my arm a couple of gentle pats to show how much he appreciated my help in apprehending the dangerous Nazi. Then probably he'd remark what a hot night it was, and maybe we ought to take a walk to the drugstore for a cold Dr. Pepper. "Oh, I'd like that, Daddy, I really would." From inside the house, I heard Ruth calling us to supper. I stood up and wondered how to go about starting from the very beginning. All the bad things were in the past. This is now, and I am his daughter, and he will love me. They say Jesus lived a truly perfect life. If I tried, really tried, I too could be perfect, or at the very least, sweet like Sharon. As my hand reached out for the door, I saw Sharon's baby Jane doll lying face down beneath the rain spout. "And I love you, love you, love you, little baby." I sat down at my place, but immediately jumped up and cheek-kissed both my mother and father before sitting down again. "Look at him now. Be sweet." "Hey, that's an awfully nice tie you're wearing. Is it from the store?" He said it was. A compliment about the store. Maybe that would please him more. "That sign you put up over the shoe department? The large red one that says shoe department. What a good idea. Is it good for business?" His head was bent.
"Eat your dinner and don't ask so many questions."
"But did you know that this doctor from Boston, I read it somewhere, said pleasant conversation is good for the digestive system?"
"And I told you to shut up and eat your dinner."
His anger ended my flirtation with perfection. If there were questions or confusion before, they weren't there anymore. I knew what I was going to do. And I knew why. He lifted a fork overburdened with mashed potatoes, and I watched as the gravy started to roll down his chin. Across his mean, thin line of a mouth, he smeared the paper napkin. "It's not even a contest leaving you, dear father. I know it will be difficult for you, deciding what to tell people. But will you miss me?" "And what about you, Mother? Will I miss you? And do you love me? I only know for sure that we've never liked each other. Anyway, it'll be easier loving you from a distance. And Sharon, I'll love you no matter where I am.
Sharon and Ruth. That's who I'll miss.
Ruth came out of the bathroom wearing her blue rayon walking home dress, and at the bottom of the V-neck was the rhinestone pin in a flower design that I gave her last Mother's Day. In a brown grocery sack, she carried the cotton house dress that always got a washing and an ironing every time it got a wearing.
"I'll walk you a ways," I offered.
When we reached Nigger Bottoms, Ruth said that it was getting on toward 7 and I'd best be turning back.
"Well, before I go,"
I said, wondering what I was going to say next,
"I want to wish you a nice evening and goodbye."
Ruth smiled and wished me a pleasant evening. Then her forehead wrinkled up, and I expected that I was in for some kind of warning.
"Now, honey babe, I don't want you nowhere near that garage, you understand? Anton's gonna be leaving after dark, and it won't do nobody no good if the law catches him here. No Jewish girl and no colored woman needs that kind of trouble."
I hated seeing her so heavy with cares.
"Ruth, you oughtn't to worry. This doctor in Boston says that worrying makes you feel old before your time."
"This here doctor from Boston you're always talking about," she said. "Did he say what you're supposed to do with your burdens? They got pills in Boston for that?"
When she gets sarcastic, there's not much I can think to say to her. But I didn't want to leave her like that. I guess I didn't want to leave her at all.
"Well, now," I said, grabbing her hand, "you be good now."
What a stupid, idiotic last goodbye thing to say, even for me.
"Well, Ruth," I said, trying again, "goodbye."
As I turned, I caught a look on her face of surprise or suspicion. I walked on, feeling a painful pinching against the hollow of my stomach.
"Well, see you tomorrow,"
I called out, and without even turning to look, I knew her doubts were being laid to rest. I found my bedroom in quiet shadows. I was aware of the room like you are when you look, I mean really look, at something for the first or last time. The twin maple beds with their matching yellow and blue chenille spreads. The linoleum with its pictures of the cat and the fiddle and the old lady in the shoe that had been a source of embarrassment for quite a few years now. I remember Edna Louise looking at that linoleum and saying, "I haven't liked Mother Goose in years." The only thing that I really liked in my room was the desk my grandma had bought me. Inside was my simulated leather 5-year diary. I wanted to record my life so I wouldn't forget anything, but then I discovered there wasn't much worth remembering. For a while, I tried to use my diary for self-improvement. I made 3 vertical columns down the page and marked the headings, date, criticism, from whom. I thought if I could see them written down, then correcting my shortcomings might not be all that difficult. I didn't have to wait long for my first entry. 5:15:41. 7:35 a.m.
"Get that hair out of your face."
"Mother."
5:15:41. 7:45 a.m.
"Even when you comb it, it doesn't look it. Can't you get that dirt hair out of your face?"
"Mother." Water began to drain noisily down the pipes. Sharon shrieked for a towel. Still time enough for packing. What did I need? Springy tennis shoes for jumping aboard slow-moving freight trains, polo shirts that never need ironing, blue jeans that save the legs from cockle burrs, and a sweater for when the nights turn chilly. And, in case we go out together in some distant place, a dress. In the bottom drawer of the kitchen cabinet, Ruth stores dozens of neatly folded grocery sacks. I picked one for my suitcase and thought of Robert's suitcase, the one the whole church chipped in to buy him. How proud he must have felt. All those people wishing him well. After the 9 o'clock news was over, the big upright radio in the living room was snapped off, and my mother and father began readying for bed. At 9:30, his breathing deepened into snores, and I guessed that my mother must be sleeping too. Sure she was. Haven't I heard him joke about it? Pearl falls asleep on her way to the pillow. The unhooked window screen pushed out with a sound so slight that I didn't bother to check to see if Sharon slept on. I dropped my paper bag to the ground and started to follow when I thought of something. I went over and stood for a moment by my sleeping sister. Sharon laid curled on her side, just a small, soft thing, her lips resting against her thumb. Already past the age when she needs to thumb suck, but not yet ready to stop keeping it handy. "Well, be good now," I said. "I sure hope you grow up nice." Sharon's reluctant eyes opened. She took hold of my hand and closed her eyes again. As I tried to loosen my hand, she seemed to get a better grasp, like she didn't want me to go, or maybe she didn't want me to go without her. "Want to come along?" I whispered. Groaning like her sleep was being disturbed, she released my hand and turned over. Outside, the darkness was complete. I walked by the sand pile and the chinaberry tree whose strongest branch supported our chain swing. The seat had been cut from an old restaurant sign, and there was still the word "Eats" painted in faded red letters. Is this how it all ends? Leave everything you know, and all that comes to mind is trivia, sand piles and chinaberries. I left my sack at the foot of the garage steps and crawled my way up through the blackness. "Anton," I whispered. But behind the closed door, there was only silence. A feeling of loss swept over me. "Anton," I cried, hitting the door with my fist. "It's me, Patty." Abruptly, the door opened. "Quiet." As he led me through the blackness, I tried to find my voice. I thought you had gone," I said, and then from somewhere came crying. Only after my tongue had tasted saltiness did I know its source. Anton squeezed my hand. "I'm sorry," I said. "I didn't know I was going to do that." Anton brought my hand to the slightly moist inner corners of his own eyes. "Just wanted to point out that the biggest difference between us is that you cry more noisily than I." I laughed, feeling grateful for the darkness which concealed my eyes. We both knew that I couldn't stay. It had to happen, PB, you always knew that. "No, I didn't." I breathed in deep. "Anton?" I needed to say his name aloud again as though it were a magical incantation. Anton, I won't even be that much trouble. What I'm trying to tell you is... The hurdle felt too high for vaulting. PB, I don't think... Don't talk, listen to me. It was my hurdle, and I had to clear it myself. I don't think you ought to leave me, not now. I haven't learned all those things you were going to teach me. Things about Emerson and... Oh, Anton, let me be with you. Go where you go. His thumb pressed against my palm. You know what you are asking is impossible. But if you're saying that you love me... Yes, I answered, wondering if it came out audibly. Yes. Then know this, Patty. It's not completely one-sided. I love you, too, and in my own way I'll miss you. He opened the door, climbed quickly down, and offered up his hand to me. Outside, the moon, almost full-grown now, threw soft illumination on his forehead and cheeks while leaving the deeper recesses in shadows. Then it struck me that if someday I grow old and forgetful, forgetting even friends' names and faces, his face I could never forget. He looked down at the luminous hands of his watch. The train comes by about 10:15. Yes, I replied, and then, thinking that my answer sounded curt, I added, Yes, it does. Let me help you back into the house, he offered. There's still time. I began to feel jealous of time and trivia, of last moments consumed in pass-the-salt type of comments. No thanks. My bedroom window screen is unhooked and the water spigot is there. Makes a good foothold. Well, I must say goodbye now. Oh, I almost forgot. I dug into the right-hand pocket of my jeans. Here's some money. Only $4.65. It's all Ruth and I had. He took the money. Thanks for this. For everything. And I have something for you, too. It belonged to my father and even his father before that. Anton looked down at his hand. Then warm metal encircled my finger. This ring was made by Germany's most famous goldsmith for my great-grandfather when he was president of the University of Göttingen. The crest represents the office of the president. A thing of value. He'd given it to me? Maybe you'd better keep it, Anton. I mean, it has been in your family for so long. My tongue. I could bite it off. The ring had been mine for only a moment, and now I would lose that, too. The greater the value, the greater the pleasure in giving it. The ring is yours, P.B. Then in the darkened silence, I heard him breathe in deeply. Am I still your teacher? Without pausing for an answer, he continued, Then I want you to learn this, our last lesson. Even if you forget everything else, I want you to always remember that you are a person of value, and you have a friend who loved you enough to give you his most valued possession. I will, Anton. I'll remember. I saw or felt it coming. my chin tilted up as my eyes closed. Then our lips touched, lingered together briefly before going their own separate ways. When I opened my eyes, Anton was gone.